Currently, there are 38 shows running on the Great White Way, which is the Broadway stage. And out of the 38 shows, one of them is written by Black people about Black people. Ain't Too Proud to Beg, the jukebox musical about the Temptations, is written by the brilliant Dominique Morisseau. She wrote the book, and of course the music is the Motown catalog, which actually had some white writers in it as well, but that is the only show that features, that is a story about Black American people. I think that's very telling, because theater is not only about what we decide to mark in history, so theater is about the historical archive, but theater is also about our dreams and what we escape into imagining. There's theater that is escapism, that is supposed to take us away from reality and give us a fantastic release, and there's theater that centers us on the present to make us focus and pay attention, and theater that takes us to the past to learn a lesson. And out of 38 plays, there is only one that is focused on Black Americans, written by Black Americans. And that is the performance of Race in America. There are other shows that feature Black actors in roles, but it's not about Black people. The show that probably has the most Black bodies on stage would be The Lion King. And I don't even have to start talking about how problematic that is. And Disney's history, and as I said that I'm going into it, Disney's history of presenting Black people as animals. We can go back to Song of the South, we can go back to The Crows and Dumbo, and come all the way to the trolls in Frozen, the gospel-singing trolls in Frozen. Which is interesting in itself, because there are people of color, not African, but there are people of color in that Nordic region that could have been featured in the Frozen story. And we talk about that in another place in this podcast. But they just aren't Black bodies on Broadway that are telling Black stories. And you immediately will jump to, well, what about Hamilton? We've got to remember, my children, that Hamilton is Black faces telling white stories. Alexander Hamilton was white. Let's remember that. The Shuler sisters, white. Those characters are white characters, literally in Black face. Now let that fact blow your mind and focus you on why is that show so popular. And that is not denigrating the wonderful talent of Lin-Manuel Miranda and his marketing genius in knowing that white people would flock to white stories being told by Black and brown bodies, because it's authorized, rubber stamped, endorsed blackface. The material is brilliant. It's beautiful music. It's well crafted. The choreography is sickening. It's technically and proficiently done. I would say virtuosic in performance. But it is literal blackface, white stories, white lives told via Black and brown faces. So, but back to Ain't Too Proud to Beg, the Temptation story, and that being 1/38th representation of Black stories being told on Broadway. And we can go through the other ones. I mean, you look at, you know, a Broadway show that's very popular right now that's breaking box office records, again, for a play. It's not a musical. We'll call it a play, I guess. Because there's the official designation of straight play, quote, versus musical, but we'll just call them all plays, and I'll just speak about them separately. But To Kill a Mockingbird is the classic white savior trope, so of course that would be popular. That's always popular. That's what every film is today, almost, down to that. Well, that's a digression, but To Kill a Mockingbird is the white savior trope, and I just watched this is Saturday morning, and I just watched CBS Saturday, and Hadestown is getting so much acclaim right now, and the music is wonderful, so well done. And a white woman, Anais Mitchell, wrote the piece. She wrote the book and the lyrics, which is interesting. I'm actually excited to see a show come forth that's written by one person, because that just doesn't really happen anymore today. The shows are written by 2, 3, and 4 people now, so for one person to write book and lyrics again, it harkens back to the beginning of musical theater. Pardon me, I have my coffee here. So kudos to her. But then the semiotics of race hit me in that production, because here we have a truly multicultural cast where I'm seeing a rainbow of colors on stage. And it hit me that these are all denizens of hell. So the shows that have the most black bodies on stage are black people as animals in The Lion King, or actual denizens of hell in Hadestown. With the beautiful exception of Ain't Too Proud to Beg. And Hadestown has even more problematic racial overtones, because you think of the doomed union of Orpheus and Eurydice, and so they're done, they're doomed, only to be together in hell when she died, when, you know, he wins the bet and begins to walk out of Hades and then turns back, and she's lost to hell forever, and then he's doomed to opine over her until he joins her in hell when he dies. And it's like, oh, so an interracial couple can only be together in hell. That's great. And then the other show that's very popular now that's an interracial couple is Frankie and Johnny, because it's Audra McDonald and Michael Shannon. And that's also a troubled relationship. So you just got to look at how race is being played out and portrayed in the American theater, and it's a problem. But thank God for Ain't Too Proud to Beg. Kudos to that show. And go see all of these shows. Go support the American theater, but let's be intentional about how we digest how race is performing.
To mean that I continually revisit things that wound me emotionally and intellectually, and I think, well, I know, I get some kind of dopamine release from the exquisite pain of, be it unrequited love or a situationship that I'm in that is causing me agita, or, you know, that song that just cuts you to the core, to the deep, and brings you to some kind of catharsis that you want to run back to over and over again, or that movie, that rom-com that takes you through it. And I'm as I'm thinking out loud, I'm transitioning into the fact that we're all cutters in some kind of way in that form. We're all doing that little bit of self-harm that feels good to cope. And why? You know, why do we go to this place of hurt for relief and release? I guess it's a spiritual and emotional bloodletting, you know? It's the leech that we put on our soul that will suck out the poison and allow us to be free. But man, I will keep going back to that toxic relationship or that failed whatever it is so that I can, I don't know, feel the pain of letting them go or the joy. I don't know what it is, but I will just continue to work that thing. Oh.
Elizabeth Jennings Graham is a name that you need to know. She was Rosa Parks way before Rosa Parks. In 1854, this brilliant black woman got on a New York City streetcar, which were horse-drawn at that time, and she was immediately told by the white driver that she had to get off, and she said no, and physically clung to the carriage as he tried to put her off, and they rode along until he found the aid of a policeman who literally picked her up and threw her from the streetcar onto the ground. But he messed with the wrong black woman that day because she had connections. Her father was prominent, and that connected her to the abolitionist and lawyer friend to the family, Chester Arthur, a white ally who pled her case in court, and they sued, and she won a court case, which eventually led to the desegregation of all New York City transit systems in 1865. So she won in 1855, and then a decade later in 1865, that led to the desegregation of all New York City transit systems. So you can thank that brilliant black woman for integrating the New York City transit systems and black people being allowed to sit down on a streetcar train wherever and not be denied access. Although the ruling was interesting because it said colored persons, if free, quote, free from disease, sober and well-behaved, end quote, shall have no barred access. So it's probably still on the books that way too. Which is kind of ridiculous because, you know, you can be a drunk white person and be on a bus or train or and have a disease and be on a bus or train or whatever, but I digress. Anyway, kudos to the black excellence of this woman saying no and standing up decades and decades and decades before Rosa Parks, who we all know. Also, there was a black woman by the name of Claudette in the South who refused to get off the bus before closer to Rosa Parks' time, who was not chosen by the civil rights movement as the woman to galvanize because she was a single unwed mother. And respectability politics played into her not being able to be the figurehead because rightfully so in brilliant strategy, they knew that if they didn't have the quote-unquote perfect model of respectability, that it would not galvanize the people and it would not be able to be used as leverage because the first figurehead always has to be quote-unquote the perfect moral figurehead, right? That's what the oppressor does to you. You have to be perfect, but they don't. To be let in. That's why in that ruling it's worded so well, right? So black persons are allowed onto a conveyance that they've paid for if they are, quote-unquote, free from disease, sober, and well-behaved. Once again, that respectability politics bent to it, which you can then also see play out in modern politics, not only for race. You know, you look at Barack Obama or Kamala Harris. They have to be perfect, brilliant. Kamala Harris wears pearls all the time. Her hair is straightened. She's light-skinned. Barack Obama was biracial, right? Brilliant. Law review editor. Top, 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 top. You can't just be a normal person of color, the average story. You have to be the top to be accepted, right? And then you can even translate that into other people who are oppressed. Elizabeth Warren, right? Brilliant, tenured professor, right? To be in contention, right? As opposed to Donald Trump, who doesn't have a third of the credentials. I was going to say something derogatory, but I will give him the respect that he does in other people and say that, you know, he is lacking in the same credentials, right? Of education, of career credentials, right? Nowhere near the level of a Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State, right? Trump had never held office, yet he was on equal footing with a woman who was the most vetted candidate ever for presidency. So you see how respectability politics works. When you are a woman, when you're a person of color, when you are queer, as Pete Buttigieg is, for him to be in contention with Donald Trump, and if you have followed me on social media, you know I'm no big fan of Pete Buttigieg because he's anti-black in practice. But for him to even be, for my example, for him to even be thought of to be credentialed, to be on par to run against Donald Trump, he's out and gay, but he speaks, what, 6-7 languages? He's extremely intelligent. He's been a mayor of a town. Donald Trump's never been in government before, you know? So he already, Pete Buttigieg was in the military, already has so many levels of credentials that outrank, as it were, Trump, to be equal to him, to be even thought of in contention for the same office. Minorities, queer people, women, people of color, black people, we have to overachieve to be even in contention with your average white person, white guy, white straight male, I'll say. So Elizabeth Jennings, bring it back to her, because that's what this was about. Kudos to you for standing up in the 1850s and saying, hell no, I paid for my seat. I get to have my seat. GTFO of my face. Black excellence. Harvey Weinstein is about to settle his civil case against his accusers for about $44 million. The criminal case has been shrouded under secrecy because the Honorable Judge James Burke has decided to seal documents, seal all motion filings, clear the courtroom of media, because he said that any kind of media coverage from within the courtroom, any details that would come out, would make an unfair case for Harvey Weinstein and sully his reputation. Meanwhile, in the Bill Cosby case and the R. Kelly case, we had a moment-by-moment, blow-by-blow detail expose in the news every second on Twitter and everywhere else about the intimate details of the case, what the women said, how many women there were, where the acts happened, what allegedly took place. From soup to nuts, we knew every single detail, sullying the jury pool, poisoning the jury pool. This is what James Burke talked about. He was worried about corrupting the jury pool, leaking this information out. But that wasn't a concern in the Cosby case or the R. Kelly case. Obviously, Judge James Burke was not the judge in either one of those cases, so I'm not saying bad about him, but I'm saying, do we see how race is playing out here? The rich white man is getting the court to bend over backwards to protect his reputation, whereas two different black men, both R. Kelly and Bill Cosby, had their name dragged through the mud in public in their trials? Do we see how race plays out here? Shouldn't they have been afforded the same secrecy? Or shouldn't Harvey Weinstein be open to the same public ridicule in the court of public opinion as Bill Cosby and R. Kelly, which he will not be now because we have no details, because the judge has decided to keep everything in secret. And remember, everyone from Mira Sorvino to Ashley Judd has accused Harvey Weinstein, actresses from decades and decades, of rape, sexual misconduct, assault, harassment, multiple accusations over decades. But Harvey Weinstein is having his reputation protected by the bench. But it's not about race, right? The Great Flood has spoken.